Welcome back to Food Toxicology. I'm Greg Muller, the instructor for this course. Last time, if you recall, what we did is try to look at the safety assessment of food additives. One of the things we tried to do is give a brief background of the scope of the use of food additives in the U.S. food supply, and then go through, from a regulatory science perspective, the approach to assessing the relative risks of using these in the human food chain. One of the things that we did was to look at a little bit of case studies of specific chemicals that might be in the human food chain. What we're going to try to do today is actually focus on about a half dozen food additives and review their toxicology. Our learning objectives here today is very simple and straightforward. We're going to try to explore some of the national and international agencies, ones that we've mentioned before, but look at how they actually study the safety of food additives. We'll try to review as well six compounds in terms of their use, their safety review, and their toxicology. These food additives will include saccharin, cyclamate, aspartame, BHA, BHT, sulfites, which we learned a lot about in our allergy analysis, and MSG, or monosodium glutamate. Well, in terms of the agencies and the safety of food additives, there's several of these internationally and nationally in terms of scientific organizations and regulatory bodies. The Joint Food and Agriculture Organization, World Health Organization, Expert Committee on Food Additives, JECFA, is one of these that has international responsibilities. They were created in 1950 by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United States, of the United Nations, and the World Health Organization. It assesses some of the food safety associated with these additives from an international point of view. They tend to use independent scientists, international scientists from various food producing and food importing countries. Now, there is also the Food Alimentarius Commission. It was established in 1960. It established international food standards, and this also was a part of the basis, or the genesis of this was for international trade in food. The Codex General Standard for Food Additives, the GSFA, is an online database. I've given you a link there so you can get an idea of what this particular document does in terms of providing a tremendous reference on allowable limits and the safety of food additives. The idea, again, is to protect health and also promote the international food trade. The toxicology evaluation is done, again, by independent scientists through the JECFA. Another group associated with reviewing the safety of food additives is the FASEB, the Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology. It does the safety evaluations for FDA, and it's done this since 1958. It did much of the GRAS, generally recognized as safe, and prior sanctioned review for FDA. As independent scientists, they're outside of the political dynamics, so to speak, that government agencies such as FDA might get pulled in different directions via the forces of politics. I've given you a link here to the FDA Food Ingredients and Packaging website that also will help you get a little bit of background about how these different societies do many of the risk assessments associated with food additives. In terms of the European Economic Community, we have the Scientific Community for Committee for Food, the SCF. This is close to the FDA, but it's for the entire European community. It does review food safety issues, and it uses independent scientists in a very similar fashion. Now, what we're going to try and do today is do a fairly brief focus on six food additives. These have a little bit of history. Each one of these in their time has grabbed headlines. You'll recognize all of these names. And in fact, most people in terms of the general public will recognize these names in terms of common food additives that have had a significant amount of controversy and potential public health impact. These food additives include saccharin cyclamate, aspartame, BHA, BHT, the phenolics, antioxidants, sulfites, which generates a little bit of allergic response in some people, and MSG, or the active ingredient for Chinese restaurant syndrome. For saccharin, it was actually discovered in 1859, discovered accidentally. It was found to be about 300 times sweeter than sugar. The chemical formula for saccharin is on this particular slide. It's highly regarded because it's heat stable and has a long shelf life. It was originally used for diabetics that had to limit their sugar intake. It does have a slightly bitter or metallic aftertaste for those of you that have used saccharin. It is synergistic with other sweeteners, and it has been formulated in 1:10 ratio with another artificial sweetener, cyclamate. Saccharin was controversial from the beginning. Harvey Wiley, the chief chemist of the Food and Drug Administration that we talked about in the late 1800s, early 1900s, actually wanted to ban this as a food additive based on scientific studies available at the time. Because it was in such wide use in the early part of the century, there was a significant amount of public outcry, including the comment from then President Theodore Roosevelt that anybody who says saccharin is injurious to health is an idiot. It was banned for a short time. It was reinstated in World War I, and this had a lot to do with just resources management and rationing of sugar resources. It was used extensively in World War II as a sweetener as well. In 1958, because of all of the changes to the FFDCA, it was actually given GRAS status as prior sanctioned food additive. In 1972, there were two studies published that indicated that it was a bladder carcinogen in rats, and this started a chain of events that at that time was pretty significant in terms of the major media outlets in the United States. It was immediately removed from GRAS status in 1977. It was banned by FDA because it had such a use in terms of limiting dietary calorie intake and use in diabetics. There was a tremendous public outcry. There was 1 million letters to Congress, 100,000 letters to the FDA in terms of wanting to reinstate saccharin as a food additive in the human food chain. The 1977 Saccharin Study and Labeling Act declared a moratorium on the ban, again politics intervening in terms of congressional politics. It required a warning label on products. This generated several hundred studies on saccharin. There was epidemiological studies and chronic bioassays. Essentially, the findings of these studies, there was no effect in humans. In the year 2000, the ban on saccharin was, in fact, repealed. Its acute toxicity is about 15 to 17 grams per kilogram in the rat and mouse, and in the rabbit, about 5.8 grams per kilogram. This is in the range of, in terms of human exposure, as non-toxic if you consider the weight of a human being for acute toxicity. And the potential exposure. The acceptable daily intake based on no effect levels from FAO and the World Health Organization has been calculated at 2.5 milligrams per kilogram body weight. In terms of our conclusions about saccharin, it does cause bladder cancer in rats. We do know that. We find that it is in that category of epigenetic carcinogens that we reviewed. It's a promoter chemical. It appears to have a fairly high species specificity due to a unique protein in the target animal. In terms of rodent assays and carcinogen studies, these high doses, long exposure, many of the media outlets that reported on this kept reporting on the fact that you would have to drink cases and cases of saccharin laced products, soda for example, per day in order to have the same dose in the rat studies. The mechanism of toxicity is cell proliferation for saccharin. Our next sweetener is cyclamate, and this was discovered in 1937 by a graduate student. It's about 30 times sweeter than sugar. We have the chemical formula on this slide as well. It's got a less bitter aftertaste than saccharin. It is heat stable. That's a good indicator that it can be used in cooking. Not all sweeteners are heat stable. It's 20 times cheaper than saccharin, so it has a tremendous amount of market potential. In 1950, it was marketed as a dietetic aid by Abbott Laboratories. In 1955, the National Academy of Sciences reported it as safe for human consumption. In 1958, it was actually given grass status under the FDCA by the FDA. In 1968 and 70, there were two studies that also showed bladder cancer in this with this particular chemical compound, and in 1968, it was taken off of grass status. In 1970, it was banned from all uses. And so now you see a little bit of some of the public outcry and concern. In the short range of a couple of years, both cyclamate and saccharin were coming up with disagreeable, at least, toxicity studies, therefore removed from the marketplace, impacting many people that had grown used to and accustomed to using those products. In terms of the follow-up analyses, there were 500 new studies for cyclamate that showed no cancer. A tremendous amount of research was stimulated by this decision because of the marketplace dynamics of cyclamate. FDA would still not approve this. It could not show it was not a carcinogen. This is kind of a unique sort of approach to science. The Society of Toxicology published a position paper stating that this was a classical example of how not to interpret toxicology data. In 1984, there was a petition to reinstate cyclamate based on 15 epidemiological studies. These studies show that neither saccharin nor cyclamate cause bladder cancer. In 1985, there was an FDA cancer assessment committee that actually, from a technical basis, exonerated cyclamate. In 1985, there was also a National Academy of Sciences panel that exonerated cyclamate. It still remained banned. So why, you might ask, is cyclamate still banned if the preponderance of science supports its use as a food additive? In fact, it is approved and used in 40 countries, the National Academy of Sciences, the World Health Organization, the European Economic Community all consider it safe. The FDA scientists themselves consider it safe. Is this, in fact, just a failure of FDA to admit a mistake? Is this, you have to ask yourself, politics or and perhaps not good science. All of these, again, open to question, but the fact is that cyclamate is still banned. Our next sweetener, food additive, many of you know this as NutraSweet, aspartame. It was discovered in 1960 by a surly scientist by accident. It is very similar to a gastric peptide, aspartyl phenylalanine, a little bit of a change in terms of it has a 1-methyl ester. It's 180 times sweeter than sugar. It's a dipeptide, so very close to a natural product in terms of containing aspartic acid and phenylalanine. There's no sweet effect when you look at the individual peptides. But together they do have this sweet sensory impact. Aspartame does enhance the flavor of fruits. Its shelf life is significant, 6 months. It works best in dry formulations. However, it's not heat stable. Its sweetness does vary a little bit with product pH and temperature. It does have at least a linkage in terms of natural product safety. It is found as a natural product in dairy, meat, cereal, grains, and several vegetables. 1974, there was a manufacturer's petition for aspartame as a food additive. In this petition, there were 113 supporting studies. This is the most ever. Recall, in terms of the time frame, food technology, food processing marketplace, and the consuming public had just lost saccharin, and they had just lost cyclamate as alternatives or low-calorie food additives for sweeteners. So there was a tremendous market potential for a new compound. It was approved, but it was stayed. Stay means that it goes through the regulatory approval, but it doesn't go through a final approval process in stasis. There was a request for more information, more data. There was concerns about brain damage, mental retardation, and endocrine disruption, primarily because phenylalanine did have neurotoxic potential. Aspartic acid and glutamate are neurotransmitters, and so the relationship of these chemicals from dietary intake in food products was of concern, even though this is a naturally occurring set of amino acids. So the follow-up analyses in terms of brain and endocrine disruption were negative. It was approved by FDA in 1981, a key date. The label, however, must indicate, and you've all read this yourself if you've ever picked up a can of diet soda, phenylketonurics contains phenylalanine. These particular individuals with this deficiency actually will develop a condition called maple syrup urine syndrome on exposure to large amounts of phenylalanine. The ADI for aspartame was calculated out to be 40 milligrams per kilogram body weight by the World Health Organization. Now, in terms of some of the follow-up analyses and epidemiology, all food additives always face a tremendous amount of research review and perhaps controversy when that research produces a controversial finding. This particular one in November 1996 from the Journal of Neuropathology and Experimental Neurology is an example of some of the data that causes at least headlines for a few days. This particular title of this peer-reviewed article was "Increasing Brain Tumor Rates, Is There a Link to Aspartame?" Essentially, this paper was trying to show from a retrospective epidemiological point of view that here in 1981, when aspartame was increased, about a three-year lag time, and then a statistically significant jump in brain tumor incident rates. This work has been debated and challenged on many levels, primarily because tumor incident rates vary and they're pretty noisy, that in fact if you were to take this and broaden it out in terms of retrospective epidemiological analysis, you would see variations like this, and this is coincidental. There's not necessarily demonstration, and this happens quite often in epidemiological analysis. And that's perhaps why the authors pose this as a rhetorical question: is there a link to aspartame? And the most evidence follow-up of this is probably not, is the answer to that particular question. In terms of some of the other aspects of aspartame that we need to be concerned about in terms of its toxicological potential, it does break down to phenylalanine and aspartic acid and methanol in terms of digestion processes and biotransformation. The aspartic acid is transaminated to glutamate. Both of these are neurotransmitters. There is a diketopiperazine metabolite as well. In terms of some of the conclusions we might find in terms of the toxicological analysis of aspartame, all toxicology studies are negative at relevant doses. There is ongoing scientific study of this compound, and it has a lot to do with the insertion of this sweetener into the human diet. There may be some evidence for idiosyncratic responses, things like migraine, headaches, urticaria, or hives. Aspartame at this point in time has been endorsed by the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Diabetic Association, and the American Dental Association. So the professional organizations have entrusted their experts within their organizations to review the data and come up with an endorsement. Switching over next to the phenolic antioxidants, BHA and BHT. BHA is butylated hydroxyanisole. BHT is butylated hydroxytoluene. These have been around for quite some time. They're synthetic antioxidants. They have antimicrobial properties. They're best known for preventing oxidation or rancidity in fats. They help remove some of the negative sensory attributes of oxidized fat, the off taste and smell that we sometimes observed as products age. It's used in a variety of foods, from dry cereals to mixes, soups, potatoes, potato flakes, and cosmetics. It markedly increases the shelf-like life of these dry cereals from 2 to about 50 days, and this has to do with, again, its antioxidant activity. It greatly reduces the cost of products because there will be more shelf life of products, more life pre-processing and post-processing in terms of home cooking. In terms of its GRAS status, it was granted that with the FFDCA amendments in 1958. It was later modified. We now find that tolerances for BHA and BHT are set in each food. And for example, 0.02% of oil fat content is the limit. The ADI is calculated at 0.3 milligrams per kilogram for BHA and 0.125 milligrams for BHT. Some of the toxicology concerns associated with BHA and BHT are liver enlargement, the fact that it is stored in fat, so there is a potential for bioaccumulation. It is slowly excreted. We have observed, in terms of research studies in vitro, slowing of DNA and RNA synthesis. There is some potential for reduced cell growth in vitro studies as well, and the observation of a linkage between BHA, BHT with chromosomal anomalies. There is as well some documented case studies of idiosyncratic sensitivity of these particular compounds in terms of food intolerance of foods treated with these phenolic antioxidants. From a carcinogenicity point of view, these BHA, BHT do show positive lesions in the rat forestomach on toxicology trial. There are negative in species without this forestomach and also in the National Cancer Institute rat study. It is positive as a carcinogen in fish studies. And essentially, the results in terms of its carcinogenic potential, we seem to find that the effects seem to depend a little bit on dose, timing, tissue, and species. So there is a species sensitivity, a species-specific response in terms of potential for carcinogenesis. We do find, because it is an antioxidant, and we recall that oxidation does have a lot of negative effects when we recall our brief sub-lecture on oxidative stress. Because this is an antioxidant, there is a potential protective activity as well in vivo. Some of the positive effects: it does inhibit cytochrome P450 activation of some chemicals in the process of toxication. It does induce phase two enzymes as well. Phase two enzymes help increase the polarity of the molecules in the biotransformation process to aid in elimination, and again, a positive effect of these particular antioxidants. As well, on the other side of it, to remember that oxidized fats are not regarded as a positive thing. Oxidized fats can lead to a vitamin E deficiency, primarily through an antioxidant relationship. There's a potential for oxidative damage to cell membranes from free radical processes associated with fat oxidation, and some oxidized fats have been regarded as mutagenic, carcinogenic, or cytotoxic. And so by inhibiting these processes and the food preservation antioxidant status of foods, there have been a positive health effect associated with the consumption of these antioxidants. The next category we'll take a look at here is the category of sulfites that we talked briefly about in our food intolerance lecture. Sulfites are antioxidant and antimicrobial. They have the action of being preventing enzymatic and non-enzymatic browning of food. Sulfites have been used, as it turns out, as a food additive since ancient times. The amount added to food is limited by the off taste that can be developed and some of the nutritive value and legal regulations associated with the use of sulfites as a food product. Problems associated with sulfites: it does destroy vitamin B1 in food. There's a small percentage of individuals who have these sensitivities to free sulfite. In terms of types of people, we talked about asthmatics or atropic individuals that have high sensitivity to various types of food chemicals. But overall, less than 1% of consumers have this particular problem. The food sensitivity, food allergy response can be severe to mild. It can actually progress to anaphylactic shock and death with some individuals. In 1958, it also was given prior GRAS status. In 1986, this particular status was revoked 10 years ago on fresh fruits and vegetables. The reason was, with the new epidemiological studies on sulfite sensitivity, there was a problem in that when you walked up to a salad bar, even if you had a known allergy or sensitivity to sulfites, there wouldn't be a label where you could make a smart consumer choice. Sulfites were used on salad bars to preserve the vegetables, the lettuce, to impact the rate of browning of those materials. In 1987, all packaged food and alcoholic beverages with greater than 10 part per million sulfites required a label. The ATF, or Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Agency, manages sulfites in wine. Less than 350 part per million is the limit. The average is about 150 parts per million. In terms of some of the properties of sulfites, they do help retain some nutrients. Obviously, if you have an antioxidant compound in a food product that is being challenged by oxidation, the other antioxidants, such as carotene, beta-carotene, will remain in status in terms of its antioxidant capacity. It is prohibited from use on fresh meats, vegetables, and thiamine foods. It does help retain color in terms of things like meat products from oxidation, but it does have the potential to destroy vitamin E. The ADI has been calculated at 0.7 milligrams per kilogram body weight. In terms of exposure, that would be about 37 milligrams for a 120-pound person. The estimated daily intake on the basis of diet surveys and the concentrations assayed in particular foods calculates out to about 6 to 10 milligram, and so we're about one-third or one-fourth of the ADI on a daily basis. Our final food additive that we're going to review today is MSG, also known as monosodium glutamate. It's a flavor enhancer. It was discovered in 1907 when a Japanese researcher, Kikune Ikeda, actually saw crystals appear at the bottom of a kelp soup bowl that had dried out. In terms of its manufacturing, it's been synthesized from fermented starch, sugar cane, and sugar beets. It actually, in terms of its sensory perception, is categorized as the fifth basic taste. Umami is, or savory is how it is classified in sensory science. It is the sodium salt of glutamic acid. It's one of the most common amino acids in food and in our bodies, so it is a natural product. It's about one-fifth of our body protein. In our normal diet, we actually consume about 0.5 to 1 gram per day of free glutamate. In terms of bound glutamate, that increases to about 20 grams per day. So in terms of dietary exposure to MSG as a food additive, it's on a relatively small fraction on a relative basis. Glutamate foods include cheese, meat, peas, tomatoes, mushrooms, and some others. The CRS, or Chinese Restaurant Syndrome, is where you have probably heard of most of the impact in terms of MSG as a food additive. Chinese Restaurant Syndrome is a self-diagnosed condition. Typically, people find themselves having an onset of some sort of symptoms about 20 minutes and a duration for about 2 hours. These symptoms can include face flushing, a numbness or paresthesia, chest pains, labored breathing, dizziness, some sweating, nausea, vomiting. This complex of symptoms is referred to as MSG symptom complex. In terms of the study of CRS, most controlled studies failed to confirm that this in fact does happen. Double-blind placebo, two people that were sensitive found that there was not a dose response relationship. And we've learned in toxicology that in terms of it's critical that we find a mathematical relationship between dose and response. There seems to be equal symptoms at any dose of MSG. About 43% of 3,000 individuals surveyed had some discomfort after any meals, and so they had food intolerance, and a generalized food intolerance that went beyond the potential for MSG exposure. About 1 to 2% have some sort of allergy or intolerance associated with it, not necessarily a Chinese restaurant syndrome, but it is a specific allergy of the individual to that particular chemical compound. Other concerns associated with MSG come from the fact that glutamate is a neurotransmitter. We find that if we inject MSG into young rats, we do see brain lesions. There is no effect orally at any dose, up to 40% in the diet for adult rodents, dogs, rabbits, or monkeys. So no effect orally on dose in terms of response. And we found no effect in humans up to doses of 120 grams per day. In terms of the safety studies regarding MSG, the FASEB in 1980 and 1986 FDA, 1991 the European Economic Community, and 1992 the American Medical Association essentially concluded that a small percentage of the population may have this sensitivity to high dose MSG or Chinese restaurant syndrome. There might be a problem with atopic children, but overall there's no major health problems associated with MSG or the use of MSG in foods. The ADI was, because there is no dose response relationship, remains as unspecified. It's the safest category in terms of the safety assessment of food additives. The conclusions that we have about MSG are that Chinese restaurant syndrome is not reproducible. There might be some allowance, especially for idiosyncratic effects based on epidemiology in select populations. Some populations do carry a potential for allergy or food intolerance associated with MSG as a food additive. The preponderance of scientific studies suggests that neurotransmitter relationships of MSG are not a problem. All of the agencies in terms of food safety and public health in the United States and worldwide regard MSG as safe, and it does have GRAS status. Well, that gives you a quick additional overview or focus of these six food additives, the ones perhaps that over the past 25 years or so have appeared most often in the news, primarily because they impact our daily diet, especially if we are counting calories and looking for sugar substitutes. If we have a sweet tooth and we can't afford the calories associated with sugar sweeteners, these are a highly desirable alternative. Well, the next two lectures, what we'll do is start looking at other aspects of food additives, but those that come from either the food production sense in terms of genetically modified organisms and how they are in the human food chain, and then another lecture on food irradiation as a technique for food processing to minimize the potential for foodborne illness. Until that time, we'll see you again. Thanks.